Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first day of a whole new month, October. This hour, we're going to talk about fabulous storytelling and listen to some fabulous storytelling as well. In 1997, The Moth was formed, and it's been presenting thousands of stories told live without any kinds of notes to standing room crowds all over the world. There's The Moth radio show, which I'm sure you have heard. It is wildly popular on public radio, and their podcasts are popular as well. And now, 50 of the most, I don't know if you could say the best or the most interesting, they're a collection because there have been so many thousands of stories told. These are 50 stories that are captivating, told by people who have presented for The Moth. They're in a new book that is titled The Moth, and I'm delighted that we have with us as our guest this hour the artistic director of The Moth. Catherine Burns is joining us. We'll be welcoming phone calls. As you know, The Moth is a traveling show, and there's going to be one in Milwaukee on today's Tuesday, two nights from now, so we'll tell you that. Get your stories together, and you can participate in their story slam. Our phone number, Moth fans, please call. Catherine would love to hear from you. Storytelling fans, please call as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to use that, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Catherine, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, great pleasure. Catherine, start. I asked KP to ask you to read your story because I read the part of your intro and I said to him, can you believe her story? I thought this is a fabulous story. I don't know if you've ever told it on The Moth, but this is something. Could you start just because in the spirit of storytelling, we'd like to hear your story, Catherine.
Yes, I'd be honored.
Thank you.
So in the early 1970s, my mama heard that a nice young woman novelist was staying in a cabin down the lake from our house. I lived in a small town in Alabama, and called her up, having never met her before, and invited her over for lunch. So one of my first memories is four-year-old me sitting down at our kitchen table to dine on mini pimento cheese sandwiches and deviled eggs, and my mama introducing me to our guest, Miss Harper Lee. She had come to my tiny hometown in Alabama to do research for what she thought might be her second book. When I thought back on this as a teenager, I was kind of blown away by my mama's kindness, but also by her audacity. I said, Mama, you just called her up and invited her over to lunch? She just won the Pulitzer Prize. But Mama just shrugged and said, well, I didn't know about that, but she was new in town and living down the street, and I wanted to be neighborly. You got to get to know your neighbors. You never know who's in line in front of you at the grocery store and what's been going on with them. 30 years later, I'm in New York City at The Moth.
Oh, I love that story. Don't you wish you had that conversation recorded somehow? Oh, what a priceless thing that would be.
Oh, my goodness, how I would kill now to have that, you know?
And it also just speaks to human kindness because your mom was just being neighborly, Harper Lee or not, Pulitzer Prize winner, so what? She was a new neighbor.
That's exactly right. And I don't think I even understood what had happened, you know, from like a more meta point of view, if you will, until I was in junior high and reading To Kill a Mockingbird. And I was like, oh, my goodness.
Right. Yeah. It's such a story. Oh, I love that story.
Thank you.
You were reading 16 years worth of stories. That's a lot of stories. And you say that we're used to hearing them on the radio where they are so incredibly powerful. I got to tell you, they take you off the side of the road and you got to listen to them.
Oh,
but you say that you were also astonished by their power in print.
We were, you know, when Hyperion first came to us and asked us to do a book, we were a little unsure. I mean, our whole thing is, you know, true stories told live, and, you know, that live is very important. We don't allow the storytellers to have notes. So the idea of putting them on a page maybe seemed a little at odds with what we were about. But then what we discovered is when we transcribed some of them, it's that they not only worked on the page, but they almost had a new power in print. Like there's something very intimate about holding the stories in your hand. And what's nice about reading them is, you know, if you're in a live event, someone's talking and they say something and it makes you think about something that happened to you. While you're off thinking about that, now they've gone on and 3 minutes have gone by and you've missed what they're saying. What's about the book is you can pause, think about reflecting on your own life, think about what, you know, how this story might be affecting you, and then go back into it. And we just thought that was really, it was really just a new way to experience the stories.
the beginning of the book talks about this, and I think this is really important, that we spend so much time wrapped up in these little boxes with our fingers on a keyboard, and human beings weren't meant to live this way. We're supposed to connect with each other. Those instruments really don't, which perhaps is one of the reasons for the success of the moth, don't you think?
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, Adam Gopnik, who actually wrote the intro to the book, he likes to say that all these little instruments, that they kind of connect us. That people say they want to connect, but what they really want to do is kind of connect. And I think that that's true. And I think that, in the end, you know, human beings weren't meant to live that way. I think that we need that direct experience with others. And so I think the moth, in many ways, is medicine for that.
Tell me, it was a terrific idea, but I'm sure that it was not easy to put all of this together. Somebody had an idea, and then you went with it. Who had the idea, and how was the moth initially implemented?
Well, so the moth was founded by the novelist George Doss Green, and he grew up on St. Simon's Island, which is a little island off the coast of Georgia. And they didn't have cable. There wasn't that much to do. And so he and his friend Wanda, and their friend, they had a lot of friends, they would gather on Wanda's porch, and they would drink bourbon, and they would tell stories. And there was actually a hole in the screen, and moths would flutter around. And so they started them calling themselves the moths. They would say, the moths will meet tonight. So years later, George grows up and moves to New York City. And he was struck by this cocktail party chatter, and he likes to say that he felt like nobody was really listening to anybody else. They were just kind of waiting for one person to finish what they were saying, so that they could then talk. And he missed those nights on Wanda's porch, and so he said he decided to have a night at his apartment. He had this loft apartment, and he was going to invite five people to come tell a story, and everybody would stop for 10 minutes and listen to each person. And, I mean, George, if he were here, would actually tell you the night was sort of a bust a little bit. But they kept going and tweaked it. And 16 years later, we're still here, thanks to George.
And how did it get on the radio?
Well, for a long time, we thought radio would be a good place. There's something really beautiful about the intimacy of listening to the stories, like in headphones, in audio form. Mm-hmm. And so we really wanted to do it. But ultimately, we were shepherded to the radio by the great Jay Allison. He's like a 6-time PBD award-winning producer. You know, we like to say we knew how to put together great stories, but we had no idea how to make a radio show. And so Jay, God bless his heart, stepped in and helped us. And then with the help of PRX, they're our partners, they helped get us out over the air.
And you have, tell me how this works. I know there's a Moth Slam taking place in Milwaukee. It's a traveling moth show, Thursday night at the Miramar Theater on Oakland. Are you doing these traveling shows all over the country?
We do. Our main stage, which is our longer stories, like on our main stage, five people come and they each tell a 10-minute story. And those we actually travel around to different parts of the country. The story slams, which are open mic story competitions, those actually have homes in town. So like, Milwaukee is one of the 15 cities that has its own story slam. Mm-hmm. We're very proud of that.
Yeah. You know, this word is coming back. We've done several shows on poetry slams, which also are very popular with high school students, and they really started a couple years ago. It is remarkable to hear some of these young people and how they make themselves so vulnerable, and they're so poetic and everything. There is a resurgence of this in this country.
Yeah, you are not kidding. George, actually, our founder, recently helped us launch our first ever high school story slam program. And the stories that are coming out of there are just unbelievable. These kids, they stand up, they're just so in touch with who they are. And we're like, oh my goodness, who are these kids? And it's just incredible. We've been putting them on the radio at the rate of about one a month or so, because they're just so good. Like, they deserve to be up there with all the adults.
So what do you strive to be? Is there, when you think about what you want each broadcast to be, each story to be, is it inviting five people, only everybody wants to come? It's not a bust. It's always good. They come to that dinner party, or they come to a loft and they just present their stories. What do you imagine for each broadcast?
Well, I mean, we do our shows in like different types of venues around the country. In New York City, our home is mostly at the Players Club, which is like an old gentleman's club. It was literally someone's house in the 1800s.
Oh.
You walk in, and there's all the portraits on the wall. Ah. We like to say that the ghosts are cheering on the storytellers. And it's very intimate. It seats about 250 people, and it's very special. But what we hope is that each moth, that when with a successful moth, that it should truly feel like you're at a dinner party. People are up there. They're telling their stories. They're not really performing them. I mean, we have some amazing raconteurs, but the idea is that when it works, is that it really is just a very excellent dinner party story that just happens to be being told in front of 250, 1,000 people, whatever it is. It's not meant to feel like an acting monologue, if you know what I mean. It's meant to be much more realistic than that.
Mm-hmm. We have some stories that we're going to intersperse during our broadcast, and I'm going to ask you to set them up for us, if you would. The first story is Whatever Doesn't Kill Me.
Yeah.
Do you want to describe it, or should we just play it cold? It's not the whole story. It's a minute and a half.
Well, I don't know. Why don't you play it, and then we can talk about Ed, because he's a great favorite of ours.
All right. Here it is. Whatever Doesn't Kill Me.
And let me tell you, when you start your day with two homicide detectives explaining what happened the night before, it's downhill from there. They had, they began to explain to me, they had five young men in custody, and they wanted me to identify them from the mugshots before I died. And I didn't know this, but they just wanted me to make an X and next to the pictures. And what had happened is that these young men had come in from Brooklyn. They were part of a gang. And the initiation for them to move up into the upper echelons of their gang was to come into Manhattan and kill somebody. And they had set up this little ambush where they had one lookout at either end of the block. And the three guys would sit on the stoop, and they had their knives open up their sleeve like that, and they'd look out at either end, and they would wait. And it was late at night, and it was the night before Thanksgiving, so the city was really empty. And this guy walks around the corner, and he heads down the block, and the two lookouts give the go-ahead, and the three guys stand up and start walking towards him, and he has his key out, and he puts his key in the door, and he goes into the lobby, and the door closes behind him, and they're locked out, and he pushes the elevator button, and he goes upstairs, and he gets undressed, and he goes to bed, and he never knows what just didn't hit him, and I'm the next guy.
And he's the next guy. What a story that one is, Catherine. Woo!
What's funny is that I've heard this story 30 times, and I still get chills.
Oh, and that he's able to. It must be therapeutic to be able to tell that story too. But it's so awful that you could have it eat you up.
It's so awful. It's so true. I mean, I think he would tell you that it has been therapeutic. He's actually told three different stories, all sort of different takes on things that happened as a result of that. Because I mean, ultimately, the kids jump him and stab him, and it's just through a series of miracles that he didn't die, including that when he was lying there bleeding on the ground, a garbage truck went by, and one of the garbage men was a Vietnam vet who kind of had a flashback and jumped off the truck and grabbed Ed by the shirt and started slapping him in the face and was like, "Don't you fill in the blank, FCC, die on me." And Ed, they think that if he hadn't done that the adrenaline rush from having the guy slap him in the face is what literally saved Ed's life. And there was just a series of miracles like that. And so I think he feels that his life is ultimately a miracle, that he was saved. And so, and he's told many, many beautiful stories about it. And, you know, he is such a master storyteller. He's somebody who just walked into our slam one night. This is how we met him. His girlfriend at the time, now his wife, for some reason got stuck working late. And I think being there alone, he had the guts to put his name in the hat, and he was picked, and he told, you know, a 5-minute version of this story, and we were just like, who is that? And he went on to tell it on the main stage, and I mean, he's such a beautiful storyteller. One of the things I love so much about Ed is that even when he's telling such a serious story, he also manages to be things that maybe shouldn't be funny.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of my favorite moments of that, I love the clip that you picked, and like right before that, he tells you that the homicide cops had actually been assigned to his case because they were so sure he was going to die, they didn't want to bother doing the paperwork, so they just go ahead and assign homicide to it.
Oh my goodness.
Use that as an example. Yeah, like when we say show, don't tell, like it's one thing to say that you nearly died. It's another thing to say that you were so bad off the NYPD assigned homicide detectives to your case because they were so sure you were going to die in the next few hours.
Wow. Do people have theater skills at all? Do you coach people on how to tell a great, compelling story, or is it just within each of us?
Well, I think it is within each of us. That being said, we do coach the people who get up there. I mean, the stories aren't memorized, but we have an amazing team of directors, and they work with each storyteller to help them identify, like, what are the beats of the story? And, you know, who are you at the beginning? Who are you at the end? Like, what the arc of the story is? Because 10 minutes isn't a long time. And in order to really get your thoughts together and tell a compelling story in just 10 minutes, you need to have practiced a little bit.
We welcome phone calls for Catherine. We're talking about The Moth this hour. There's a book now that's a compilation of 50 true stories that are part of The Moth. And interestingly, they read. I mean, I like the spoken word, but they read almost as well as they sound. It's some of the people who were participated in Moth presentations, and I think there are a couple that have not been heard for audio reasons, that they come from parts of the world where the sound was kind of muddled. We'll ask Catherine about that. We're talking about The Moth, or the collections in this book, storytelling in general, how it seems to be experiencing a resurgence these years. What is it that we're missing in our modern world that makes these? Obviously, nothing beats a great story, right? We all like great stories, but what is it that's really attracting us to this kind of radio, to these kinds of books right now? It says something about what we don't have in our society where we're online all the time, alone. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. They're all available to you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and we'll go to phone calls in just one moment. Before we do that, let's hear another story, because we have several of them for you to listen to, and they're also compelling. This one is Adam Gopnik, LOL. Should we just listen to it again and then have you talk more about it, Catherine?
Sure, that's fun, right?
That is fun. All right, let's have some fun. Here's a story, LOL.
I loved instant messaging once I'd gotten the hang of it. I loved the simplicity of it. I loved the autonomy of it. And I loved the abbreviations, the language of abbreviations that instant messaging has. And Luke taught me all of the abbreviations. BRB means be right back. U2 means U2. GTG means got to go. And then there was one that he didn't even have to teach me because it was so self-evident, and that was LOL. And I knew right away that it meant lots of love because he put it at the end of every message that he sent me. And even when I sent him a really sententious message, you know, one of those things, just do the things you've got to do and then you'll be able to do the things you want to do. I had homework too. He would always write back, okay, Dad, LOL, Luke. And I was really moved by this. Because even when I was lecturing him, he was able to absorb it in a mature way and send lots of love back to me as he thought about it. And I thought, this is such a beautiful telegraphic abbreviation for the 21st century, because it's like a little arrow of love you can send out to anybody you know. And for the next 6 months, I was infatuated with instant messaging and its power of emotional transmission, and I sent LOL to everybody I knew. My sister was getting divorced out in California, and I wrote to her, we're all behind you and beside you, LOL, your brother.
I can understand how he would have made that mistake. That's really a priceless clip, isn't it? It's just priceless.
Oh, my God, it's the best. Adam is just, he is one of the great voices of our generation, I feel.
It's so natural, so completely natural.
So completely natural. Like, from the very moment he told us to write them off, which at this point was, gosh, I think 12 years ago, he was just such, it was like a star is born. And that was his second story. And it's just, he's so wonderful. He posts for us all the time. We're so lucky that he, you know, he's like a big brother to us.
Oh, let's take some phone calls. Leah in Green Bay. Hi. Leah, are you there?
This is Leah.
Hi, Leah.
This is Leah.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hi. Well, I'm calling because I just had this sudden insight. I collect stories from people because I help them write their memoirs. But when you asked the question, I wonder why storytelling is having a resurgence. I realize we're starved for voices. We don't even talk on the phone as much.
That's
we
right.
Email. We text. We do all these things, but we don't talk to each other. Even kids sitting next to each other are just emailing each other and texting each other, and maybe we need human voices in our lives.
I'm with you on that. It's true. We don't even talk on the phone anymore, Catherine.
They don't. It's true. It makes me a little bit crazy. I'm a somewhat reluctant texter, I've got to say. And it's true. And there was something that the power of the human voice, like there's so much emotion and so much that we transmit that, you know, is often even unspoken, you know, in our tone. And we lose that when we sit and, you know, typing to these little devices. And I think it's really important to connect in these ways. You know, I also think it's very hard to connect in a meaningful way. I mean, and talk about what's really going on in our lives, like what matters. And it's important to stop and slow down and think about life every once in a while and think about how life is affecting us.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, people have written about all the texting and everything, that it's easier somehow for us to be in Facebook and all of those venues, to be anonymous and to be maybe a little bit more hurtful, not as kind to each other as we would be in spoken conversation. Do you think there's any truth in that, that there's something that's not genuine and maybe even can be nasty when we don't have the spoken word?
Well, I think so. I mean, I have a friend who used to go spend, I think it was like every Sunday night, he went to dinner with his grandparents when he was a kid, and he was reluctant to do it. And so he'd always try to get out of it. And his mother would say, okay, you can get out of it, but you have to call grandma and tell her yourself.
Uh-huh.
And then that would be the end of it, because he wasn't going to call.
Right.
He could not stand the heartbreak. And but these days, if he could text or if he could email, maybe he could get away with it. But I was like, yeah, because I have a 3-year-old.
Right.
But there's something about if you have to actually hear the other person's reaction at the other end, it's much harder to, you know, hurt someone's feelings and to just be nasty for no reason. I mean, not that he was going to be asking to his grandmother, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. That's a great example. Leah, thank you. Eric in Endeavor, hello.
Hello, I'm actually down to 0 Facebook friends.
0?
Yep, I haven't watched TV in 4 years. I quit using the internet. NPR is my only source of media from the outside, and my favorite show is The Moth.
Oh,
and for years, people,
thank you.
People have told me I should go on The Moth because I'm funny, I'm entertaining, I've lived a fantastic life, but lately I've been intimidated by the fact that most of the people I hear in The Moth now are like professional comedians, or they seem like professional storytellers because they've been on so many times. And
yeah, I got to say, maybe kind of, like with us, but oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go on, sorry.
Carry on,
Eric. I'm intimidated by that right now, so go ahead.
Okay.
I mean, really not as much. I mean, sometimes people do tell a lot of stories, like Ed, but you know, Ed, who we heard earlier in the hour, had never been on stage, you know, at all, as far as I know, before he got up at that slam. Of course, now he's told 4 or 5 stories for us, and he did a TED Talk, and he's done all of these things. But at the time, he hadn't. This is part of, we have a team of directors and producers who work with people, because it's really important to us to hear from people whose voices might otherwise go unheard. I mean, one of the great successes of the last 3 years for us is we started this thing called the Pitch Line, which the Corporation for Public Broadcasting helped us launch. And anyone can call and leave a 2-minute pitch of a story they might want to tell. And you know, hundreds, actually at this point, thousands of people have called. We call people back. And at this point, about one person a month appears on a Moth stage somewhere in the country who called the Pitch Line. And many of them had not been on stage. Recently, we had a woman tell a beautiful story at the Fitzgerald Theater in Minneapolis about, and the story was about her baby dying of SIDS. It was a heartbreaking story, And she walked out in front of, 1,200 people, I believe it is, at the Fitzgerald. But the last time she'd been on stage was at her high school graduation to collect her diploma. So it really is our intention to go out and to try to find people and help them get up the courage to get up there, because we're not just about people like Adam Gopnik, who writes for The New Yorker, telling stories, as much as we adore him.
Thank you, Eric. So
please, you should call our pitch line. I hope you will.
What's the number?
Oh, goodness. That's terrible. Here, hold on. I'll get it for you.
No, don't do it now.
I ought to have it memorized.
It's all right. We'll have a pause coming up. Don't do it now. I don't know what I would do without you. All right. Thanks very much, Eric, for the call. Amy on email says, and we'll play a story that exemplifies this. It's like reality TV without the petty drama. It's voyeurism into snapshots of people's lives. And a case in point, you can tell us more about this after we hear a little bit of Elna Baker on Yes Means Yes.
And, I know that, Mormons are notorious for saying no to things. And yes, you would think as a person who says no to a lot of things, I wouldn't be any fun. But while I say no to some things, I try to say yes to everything else, which makes me like a really enjoyable person. And I learned the power of saying yes when I was going to NYU. They used to have these career fairs, and I was a drama student, so they wouldn't even set up booths for us. But for all the business school students, they had tons and tons of booths with the coolest free trinkets they would give away. And I discovered if I said yes to all the questions they asked, I could get presents. They would be like, are you a Stern student? Yes. Are you interested in a job at Morgan Stanley Dean Whittier? Yes. And if I answered yes enough, I would get a cool triangle highlighter with three different colors.
She's funny, isn't she?
She's the best. Oh, my gosh. Elna is so funny. She's another person who I think now has written books and has done so many things. But at the time, she was just out of NYU and, walked into the Moth, and there you go. I mean, what an incredible voice, right?
Yeah,
she's so funny.
Definitely. Joan in Milwaukee. Hi. Joan, are you there? Well, Joan's gone. Call us back. Don't know where you went. Jack in Chicago. Hi.
Hi. Great show. I love The Moth. And I want to just say two things quickly. I think anything that puts us in touch with our own or anybody else's humanity is a great thing, and The Moth really does that. And there was one story that touched me. It was very dramatic and poignant. It's about a guy who told when he was a young kid he was chained to a hot water heater because he misbehaved at a family party, an Italian family. And he got frightened and angry, and he yelled at his uncle, if you don't let me go, I'm going to kill you. And he later told how that energy saved him when he was picked up on the road by a guy he's pretty sure later on was John Wayne Gacy, who killed young guys. And that was a strange but powerful story.
Yeah, we love him. That was amazing. He won a slam with that story, and it's completely crazy, right? Because he was able to kind of pull back on these, he was it was sort of pull, almost bring out a persona that got the guy to pull over and ultimately let him out of the car. So, it's one of those just chilling stories.
Ooh, it sure is. I don't know that story. That is chilling. And some of these stories are, I don't know what word to use. Their life isn't always lovely. They can be kind of dark.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like some of our most not popular, but the stories that resonate the most with people are quite dark, because that is the truth, is that life is, filled with beautiful, joyful moments, but it's also filled with moments of sadness. I think one of the clips that we were going to maybe listen to later is Damien Echols, who spent 17 years trapped behind bars on death row for a crime he didn't commit. And not a lot of laughs in a story like that, but at the same time, he's such a beautiful voice to listen to. It changes you to hear his story.
Well, let's hear some of that right now, now that you brought it up.
When I first arrived on death row, the guards decided they were going to welcome me to the neighborhood. So they took me to the part of the prison they call the hole. It's a very small, very dark, filthy part of the prison that's in complete isolation. And for the next 18 days, they beat the hell out of me. They used to come in at about 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, and they would chain me to the bars of the cell and beat me with nightsticks. They beat me so bad at one point that I started to blood. And I still wake up at night sometimes now dreaming that I'm blood again. They starved me. They tortured me. This eventually word of what they were doing started to leak out into the rest of the prison.
What's the rest of that story, Catherine?
Well, eventually, one of the, I think it's the chancellor, you know, who comes to speak to the prisoners, sees what they're doing to Damien. And he says, the guts, it shows how just one person can change someone's life. And he goes to the guard and says, I know what you're doing to him, and if you don't stop, I'm going to report you. And they're forced to stop and at least put him in a regular prison cell. And the other prisoners later tell Damien that they were convinced that any day now they were going to just see him go out, you know, in a body bag. Mm. But, you know, eventually he was actually freed, and he'd actually only been out of prison for about 10 months when he told this story. And when he stood on stage, I mean, you could hear a pin drop in the Players Club. He actually was wearing sunglasses because his eyes are so damaged from being in solitary for so long. Mm. And, but he's just such, you know, inspiring. I can't even find the right word, you know, man, but to listen to him, I mean, how he's come so far. And, you know, actually, you know, he ended up listening to Ed Gavigan's story that we heard earlier, and listening to Ed's story, which goes on to talk about him trying to deal with severe PTSD. And Damien was really moved listening to that story. And Ed was actually in the audience cheering Damien on when he told his story that night, which is really beautiful how it becomes a community of people supporting each other as they talk about very difficult experiences.
All right. Mm. Jack, I meant to thank you for your call. Teresa on Facebook says her whole family loves The Moth. Kids ages 3 to 11, three of them. She and her husband listen to the podcast every week. Some of their favorite stories are How to Draw a Naked Man, Wanda Bullard's story about her father letting the guy out of jail, and George Lombardi's story about Mother Teresa. It's nice.
Those are all my favorites, too.
Are they? And it's nice they listen.
They're among my favorites, definitely.
Yeah. It must be hard to have favorites, though, because there are thousands of stories
it is.
Now.
I was going to say, it's actually impossible to have favorites. It's like choosing between children for us. But
right.
They're like among our favorites, definitely.
Yeah. And it's nice that her family listens, too, isn't it? They gather around the radio or
podcast
and listen.
Yeah, I love that so much. We've been hearing that since that people like listen to the stories with their children, and that just, it means so much to us.
Let's go to Joan in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to know, Catherine, if your father was a Methodist preacher who met a motorcycle gang under good circumstances.
That was not my dad, but that was, in fact, my uncle, which, and it's funny, he had told me that story 10 years before. And the only reason I never had him tell it at The Moth was some sort of reverse nepotism that went on, where because he was my uncle, I was like, it's Uncle Wayne. You know, we take for granted the stories of the people closest to us. And then one night I was on the phone with all my Moth sisters, who are our artistic team, and I ended up telling them the story of Uncle Wayne and the motorcycle gang. And they are like, are you kidding me? And we were doing this story for the New York Public Library. The theme was OMG, stories about the sacred. And we're like, we really need a Christian point of view. And I was like, yeah, my uncle has a story. And they're like, would you please just buy him a plane ticket? And he came up and told the story. And then it really resonated with people. And he ended up being chosen for the book. But again, it was because of our staff. I feel a little defensive about it because he is my uncle. But
Is he in the book?
He is in the book, yeah. Because it was really important to us
book.
To... Yay! It was really important to us
Thank
to represent
you.
A lot of different points of views.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Well, you got to tell us some of the story now, Catherine.
Well, it's my uncle. He was a preacher. He was a student preacher in Texas in the early 1960s, and it was Easter Sunday, and he was preaching at these tiny congregations, so he actually had to drive between the congregations and preach the Sunday Easter service three different times. And so the night before, he had a youth group, and he ended up dropping the kids off and getting completely lost in rural Texas. Like, he refers to it as BC, before cell phones. So there's no one to call. And he ends up running out of gas. And the setup of the story is that he had this very highfalutin student preacher, you know, very intellectual sermon prepared for the next day. He ends up walking and ultimately being saved by a biker gang who are in this like biker bar playing pool. He plays pool with them, and they end up sort of siphoning gas. He sort of looks the other way and taking him and putting it in his car and save the day for him. And then I'll just go to the end now. The story ends with him preaching the Sunday service in this tiny congregation in 1960s Texas when the gang of bikers walk in and announce proudly that they're, he ends up telling them the story because he's like, after preaching the Easter sermon tomorrow, it was in the night before, that they're like, what's Easter? And so he ends up having to tell the Easter service instead of in his highfalutin way, he ends up having to tell it in this really down to earth. Like, there was this dude named Jesus.
Oh.
And, you know, he was born out of wedlock with this, you know, teenage mom. And they're like, yeah. So he's just filled with the message. He goes home, he totally rewrites the service. And then, of course, the punchline of the story is that the next day he's preaching and they walk in, this biker gang. You can picture these people like madmen in their outfits. And here comes the biker gang. And they say, we're here to hear the shark tell the story of Jesus again. So it's just such a unique story. I'm sorry. Oh. I got that a little bit turned around. But that's also...
It's all right. It's all right. That was good. That's great. It's a great story. We're talking about The Moth this hour. And our guest is the artistic director of The Moth. Catherine Burns is with us in... They now have a book. It's a compilation of 50 stories. There have been thousands, of course, over the years. 50 true stories as told by a number of people. Almost all have been on the Moth broadcast radio show. And we're looking at the power of story and hearing some of the stories and finding out why we long to hear these now. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's listen to another of the stories from The Moth, and this one... I'll just set it up for you. The title of it is The Day I Became a Matador, and it's A.E. Hotchner, who was a personal friend of Ernest Hemingway. Hemingway invited him to Spain for the world's greatest bullfight, and he ended up as the understudy who watches the shoes being thrown by all the women who are watching the fight. So here's the story of The Day I Became a Matador, or part of it.
And left alone in the center of the ring is a soubresaut ante with his arms full of shoes. I didn't know I could move as fast as I did to get back to that van as it was pulling out. I got back to the hotel and I went into his Antonio's suite, and Antonio said, "Hey, Pecus, you were wonderful. Just throw them on the bed." So I dumped the shoes on the bed. He said, "Come on, the wine is flowing and we've got tapas." I went over, had a glass of wine. Ernest was enjoying himself. Knock on the door. He said, "Pecus, you get that?" I open it up, and there is the most gorgeous signorina you've ever seen. She's in stocking feet. She's holding one shoe. She says, "I come for my shoe." So I usher her to the bed. I help to put the shoe on her dainty foot. And Antonio and Ernest come over and invite her for wine. And we all have a glass of wine. And there's a knock on the door. And another knock on the door. And another knock on the door. And in they came. They reclaimed their shoes. They joined the party. It was wonderful.
Now, how did that guy walk through the door?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, he really is sort of a legend. I mean, Mr. Hotchner, he actually founded Newman's Own with Paul Newman, who's a dear friend of his, too. And he's just somebody who for years people have been like, you have to get A.E. to tell a story. And we finally got him on the phone. And he's like, well, I guess I could tell the one about the time that my friend Ernest Hemingway taught me into pretending to be a matador and going into a bull ring. And I'm like, yes, please. oh, my God. He's just an amazing – I mean, he just has story after story. But this is the one that we just felt like we had to at least start off with.
He's got a delightful way of – he has a delightful way of telling a story, doesn't he?
He does. He's just the most adorable man. And you're just the nicest person. And I remember talking to him afterwards and being like, you risked your life? You risked your life? And he's like, well, you know, well, first of all, I get, he's like, with Ernest, you know, you went along or you weren't invited next time. But he also was like, you know, I would always risk for something that could become a great story. Like, you know, you have to live your life really aggressively. And I was really inspired by that.
Catherine Burns.
Send him to the Moth.
No, I'm just reintroducing you. Catherine Burns is our guest, our artistic director of the Moth. Let's go to more phone calls. Betty in Wakefield, Michigan. Hi, Betty.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a little story of my own about the LOL. My youngest daughter had dragged me kicking and screaming into this modern technological age, and we started doing the IM. She started every once in a while with the LOL on the end. I immediately, as her mother, thought that she was telling me lots of love. And so when I would reply to her many times, if I wanted to end my message, I would say LOL. And finally, after a while, she said, Mom, tell me, what do you think LOL means? And I said, well, it means lots of love, of course. And she says, no, Mom, it doesn't. It means laugh out loud. And I couldn't understand why you were sending me love when it should have been laughing.
I think a lot of people made that mistake. You got to be of a certain generation to catch on to all of that right away. I think you do. Our phone number is 800. It is lovely. Thanks, Betty. 800-486-8655. Did you ever find that pitch line number?
I did. I'm sorry. I wasn't going to leave you put down the phone. I promise. It's 877-799-MOTH.
877-799-MOTH. All right.
Yes.
Good. And we'll have one more story, and then we'll take a few more phone calls. This guy is well known, and if you could describe for us what Andrew Solomon has to say. This is the one on Notes on an Exorcism.
Yes. So Andrew is a writer, and he's written extensively about trying to cure his own crippling depression. And cause he at one point was like suicidally depressed and has really struggled with it. So in this story, his friend tells him about tribal ceremonies that happen in Africa where they treat depression in a very different way from how we think of it in the United States. So Andrew travels there originally just to talk to them and learn more about it, but ends up participating in a very direct way.
All right, here it is.
I'm not depressed now. But I was depressed for a long time, and when I finally got better and started writing about the process of recovery, I became very interested in all of the different kinds of treatment that there were for depression. And having started as a kind of medical conservative, thinking that there were only a couple of things that worked, medication and certain talking therapies, and that that was really it, I very gradually began to change my mind, because I realized that if you have brain cancer and you decide that standing on your head and gargling for half an hour every day makes you feel better, it may make you feel better, but the likelihood is that you still have brain cancer and you're still going to die from it. But if you have depression and you say that standing on your head and gargling for half an hour makes you feel better, then you are actually cured, because depression is an illness of how you feel. And if you feel really great after you do that, then you're not depressed anymore.
Andrew Solomon, and that one's on Notes from an Exorcism. How do you mix up the hour, and which do you find plays better, if anything? Is comedy, I think comedy is necessary certainly in our lives. Do you try to do half tragedy, half comedy? How do you mix it up?
Well, we do try to mix it up. You know, we don't want to ever have three stories in 1 hour where someone's in prison and someone's child dies. It's just too much for the audience. So we try to mix it up a little bit. Of course, like I feel like many of the great stories, though, are really a mixture of both, where the comedy serves to sort of move the story forward in a certain way. Maybe it gives you a little bit of break from the tension of the story. You know, it just gives you a chance to catch your breath if something's a little bit intense, and that can be really nice.
I would think there's an awful lot of work in producing all of this. The demands on production are extraordinary, aren't they, Catherine?
It is a lot of work, but I can tell you it's a labor of love for all of us who are lucky enough to call this our jobs.
And what about
you? I think we all feel like the luckiest people in the world.
Yeah, I'll bet you do. It would be a wonderful job. Have you found that you've become a story writer as a result of your involvement here?
I think to some degree, right? I mean, like you have to, you learn little tricks from people. And I mean, ultimately, you know, I hope that it then applies, that, you know, we become better storytellers ourselves. I mean, certainly people expect you to be. And so there's always pressure. Like whenever I have to go and give a talk, I'm like, I can't have notes. And people are like, of course you can have notes. And I'm like, no, I'm the artistic director of them all. It looks very bad if I show up with notes. Like, I think we put pressure on ourselves. So
it's always best if you don't have the notes, I'm sure. And there are stories in this book that we're talking about that you would never have encountered anywhere else, right? How many of these are just for the first time now in print?
Well, one of them that's very dear to me is a story told by this beautiful woman, Anait. And she told the story. We were invited by the U.S. State Department to do the moth in Tajikistan in Central Asia. And they wanted us to come over and work with war refugees. They had a terrible civil war, and people didn't really talk about the war, and they thought that maybe by taking these stories and turning them into something a little bit artistic and putting it on stage, it would be sort of a gateway into this discussion. And we met her, and she told this beautiful story about working at the university during the war, and a group of child soldiers come, and she walks into the room and finds them destroying all the musical instruments. And she risks her life. She runs in and begs for them to stop. And she ends up playing Moonlight Sonata for them on the piano. Mm. And they put down their rifles, and they listen to her. And when she's done, they leave quietly in peace. Mm. And it's such a beautiful story, but she actually told the story in Russian, which is her native tongue. And the only recording we had was, because, of course, the live show was in Russian, we rehearsed it with a translator, with this wonderful woman, Anya, translating from the Russian to the English, so I wouldn't need what's saying. And luckily, my co-director, the monologuist Mike Daisy, had the foresight to just stick a little handheld recorder under Anya, the translator's, mouth as she was translating for this last time for our last rehearsal. And, I mean, the recording, you can imagine, it sounds like it's underwater. It's a conference room. It was certainly not broadcast quality. But we were able to hear it well enough to get it transcribed. And so the story was able to go in the book, but otherwise we would have never been able, you know, we would never be able to put it on the radio because the recording was so poor.
Well, is that an unusual request, or do you get many of those to travel to another country to do this kind of storytelling?
We increasingly get requests, and we try to do as many of them as we can. I mean, we really love it. We've been to Australia, we've been to England. And we're hoping to do more of it. We're actually hoping to do more things like what we did in Tajikistan. We have a moth shop community program that teaches storytelling in schools and anywhere there might be an underserved population. We're always trying to find the storytellers who would not find us. And we're hoping to take that international soon with what we did in Tajikistan as sort of an example.
Mm. And are you doing any of that in the States, teaching storytelling?
Oh, absolutely. We have a program that does about 35 workshops a year in New York City. And we're increasingly traveling with that, too. Like, this is thanks in part to public radio stations. When we go into communities to do a live show, we'll sort of add on a workshop. When our directors are in town, we'll go out, and the station will help us hook up with a great community group, and we'll do a workshop there. And sometimes those stories that get recorded and end up on the air, so it's really special.
Oh, what a job. This is, well, you've just branched into something whose time had come. His time had been, and now realized that it was an important thing we did, was tell great stories to each other. All the best to you. It's terrific.
Oh, thank you so much. I've loved speaking to you.
Thank you. I've loved speaking to you, too. And you keep telling your stories. You've got some good ones. You've got a good...
Oh, thank you. Yeah. You're so sweet. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being with us. Our guest, the artistic director of The Moth, Catherine Byrne.
Collins talking about the new book, The Moth, 50 True Stories. And let me grab this poster that I have. The Moth is going to be at the Miramar in Milwaukee, 2844 North Oakland Avenue. It's a story slam, and it's going to be this coming Thursday. Creepy is the theme. You can sign up to tell a story, to be on a judging team, or you can just sit back and listen. We're sponsoring that. That could be a lot of fun. Go to our Facebook page for more information about all of that and the pitch line, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Tomorrow at 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by a cycling legend and the director of a documentary, Rising from Ashes, an incredible story of this cyclist who moves to Rwanda to help a group of genocide survivors pursue their dream of a national cycling team. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for producing this program.